From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Since I took a walk with today's guest about 10 years ago, I've adopted a whole different way of looking at what I might have once seen as imperfections in plants. Now when I spy a squiggle in a columbine leaf or what looks like a green ping pong ball on an oak, instead of thinking, what's wrong with my plant? I instead think, I wonder who made that and why. Curiosity has replaced panic, thanks to naturalist Charlie Eisman, co-author of the field guide Tracks and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates, who's here today to decode some of nature's beautiful little mysteries for us. So more in a moment, but first, this message.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top-quality spring-blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
Charlie Eisman is a freelance naturalist, and when he's not conducting biodiversity surveys for clients, he devotes himself to learning more about the natural world through an ebook he's created on leaf miners and a North American leaf miner project on iNaturalist that he started that has some 50,000 sightings submitted and more. Hi, Charlie, and thanks for coming indoors long enough to talk today.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So you're across Massachusetts from me a ways. I'm on the New York, Massachusetts border. So we're both Northeasterners, I should say, for perspective. And also I want to say, I'm going to do a giveaway of your field guide of Tracks and Sign with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. Because I've confessed to you and to others over the years, you know, I have this obsession with field guides and I have a big cabinet filled with them, but this one really stands out. It's just so different. And as I said in the New York Times garden column that we just collaborated on, I love it because it doesn't call out the obvious stuff. It doesn't call out, you know, beautiful bird feathers and flowers, wildflowers and stuff and butterflies. So tell us a little bit about how you kind of got into this crazy, like the tiny micro, the tiniest world of all, the invisible stuff almost.
Yeah, well, it started with just being a generalist naturalist and being into mammal tracking and having jobs where I was, my job was to identify all the plants I encountered in different plots. And so I was spending a lot of time staring at plants and noticing these signs of tiny animals. And I discovered there weren't any books to tell me what these squiggles and patterns and objects on leaves were. So I started doing the research to put together a guide so I could learn what they all were.
So necessity was the mother of invention, literally, with this thing, with this book, and with your subsequent projects too, I guess, right?
Yeah, soon after that Tracks and Sign of Insects book was published, I did a survey of the galls and leaf mines of Nantucket just for a few days. And when I got home and was trying to identify everything I found, I discovered that the leaf mines, I really couldn't get them all to species without doing this huge project to create a guide to all the leaf miners of North America, which I've kind of been doing ever since.
And you'll probably be doing it for a lot more years, because I bet there's a lot more of them than we have any idea of. So you said galls and leaf mines, leaf miners. So tell us what those are, because again, like I think I said in the introduction, even I used to see them as imperfections. Ooh, what's wrong with my plant? Who did that? Why is that way? Fix it. You know, that kind of reaction and panic almost for a gardener who wants, you know, pretty, right? So what is a gall? What's a leaf mine? What's going on?
So these are both types of insects that are basically plant parasites. They live inside the plants. But it's a relationship that's been developing over a long time. And so it's not a mutualistic, but it's certainly, it's symbiotic to the point that it's minimizing the damage to the plant. And with galls, the insects are actually modifying the growth of the plant. So the plant does all the work making this shelter around the developing insect larva or nymph. And that's caused by some combination of mechanical and chemical inputs from the insect, and in some cases, something like genetic engineering is going on, where they're either switching on and off genes, or maybe even inserting some more DNA.
So you mean humans didn't invent CRISPR? Is that what you're telling me?
Right. Humans didn't really invent anything.
Anything. They didn't invent art. They didn't invent geometry. They didn't invent, you know, intricate patterning and things that we think of as art.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And the leaf miners are definitely, some of them are real artists. In the case of leaf miners, the larvae are actively excavating the plant tissue. So everything you see in a leaf mine is the work of the insect, as opposed to the insect making the plant do something for it. But so a leaf miner is an insect larva that's feeding between the two epidermal layers of a leaf.
Right. So those squiggles, and I think the columbines, and when we've talked before, you've told me around the country, there's columbine leaf miners, insects that will mine, like you said, excavate in between the epidermal layers, make these sort of tunnels and squiggles and mazes that we see, and from where they've tunneled inside the leaf. It's quite amazing, actually, when you think about how tight a space that is and what they're doing in there. And yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, they have to be incredibly skinny to be able to do that.
So but, what kind of insects do this? I mean, what kind of groups of insects do these fall into? Because you said larvae, right? I mean,
yeah,
the larval stage.
Right. So on columbine, they're all flies. But many of the leaf miners we see are flies, but there are also moths in 40 different families that have at least some species that are leaf miners.
Wow.
And then there are some beetles, about 200 species of leaf mining beetles in North America, and sawflies, which are in the order Hymenoptera. They're like primitive wasps, basically. And there are a few dozen leaf mining species of sawflies also.
So do we call these then like host plants? Is that these host plants, right? Is that what the relationship? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I was out this morning, just early, outside the kitchen door, and a bunch of asters are growing, and there were some beautiful caterpillars. And I always think of you when I see something special, because as I said in the introduction, you know, when you took me on a walk a decade ago or whatever, and you know, you and I tease you all the time about this, we didn't get very far on the damn walk. We'd go about 2 feet and you'd see something else, and you'd say, wait a minute, we need to look at this, you know. And it was like, it wasn't a lot of progress, but it was a lot of progress, because I started to see completely differently.
It's really true. The less you move, the more you see. I actually, a couple of weeks ago, my wife and I drove to a place a couple of hours away to find leaf mines on dogwood that we had seen there a few years ago, and some species that's unknown to science. And we went and we spent hours looking, and we didn't find any there. But then just on Monday, I noticed them in my neighbor's yard. So
wow,
really didn't have to look far.
Isn't that crazy? That's really funny. Speaking of crazy things, you told me about how you spent the early pandemic lockdown months. Like, you sort of, you know, we all had to stay closer to home. What were we going to do? Some of us, you know, took up knitting or whatever, you know, and got in more into crossword puzzles or whatever it was going to be. But you set a goal to kind of do surveys, in a sense, right on your property, like an acre of space, and to count who was there. Yeah.
So I wanted to see just how many different species of leaf miners I could find in my yard, and I ended up finding 212 was the ultimate tally. And I was also looking for sawfly larvae, which are not just leaf mining sawflies, but the free living caterpillar like ones too, because I'm also starting to work on a guide to those. And I ended up finding about 50 species of those. Although I was, because I'm not done with that guide, I couldn't put names to all of them.
Right.
But I 50 different types, and I was collecting them and raising them to adults, which is a process that takes a year. You have to let them burrow into soil and refrigerate them over the winter, and then the adults emerge the following spring. But so I'm slowly getting names on all the sawflies that live around me.
So some people in their bookcases in their office, in their home office, have books, and some people have jars, little jars with bits of soil and a larva of a sawfly, and that's you. Exactly. That you're rearing. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Well, but it's and so sawflies, we should say, because again, I didn't really know what they were until I met you. And now I kind of get excited when I see right around this time of year in the Northeast for me, I have a lot of dogwood on the property of various kinds, a lot of the twiggy shrub dogwoods. And, you know, I'll see the different larval stages, and they're quite beautifully patterned, some of these dogwood sawflies at different stages. And, you know, I'll see them on the leaves of one of the shrubs or the other. And I always go up and look up in that part of the property and look and see who's doing what. And they're not hurting anything, because why? I mean, this is, like you said before, it's not, even though these are parasites, some of this behavior, it's not harming anything. And it's not symbiotic, but it's not super harmful, right? And
so with externally feeding insects like sawflies, they're definitely causing more damage than the leaf miners or the gulls are, but it's still... because these are native insects, and the plants have evolved together with them, that they're just adapted to be able to withstand that kind of thing. So I have, I just noticed this birch sapling in my yard that was completely defoliated by sawflies.
Oh,
like not a single leaf left on it. And there's a willow in my backyard like that too. And we have spice bush plants that we planted that the spice bush swallowtail caterpillars have completely defoliated. But all of these plants the next year will just be totally fine. And most of this defoliation happens at the end of the year when plants have done most of their photosynthesizing anyway. And even with the swallowtails, it happened earlier in the year, but the plants, I think they were able to put out another flush of leaves, but whether they did or not, they came back bigger than ever the next year.
So. Yeah. And really even just the fact that the spice bush swallowtail larvae, the animals found those plants, right? Because it's not like you live in a place that's 100 acres of Lindera of spice bush. Right. Same thing for me. Years ago, I planted those in my garden, and I've always had that butterfly, you know, in their caterpillars. And, you know, it's like they find it. It's just that in itself is miraculous, let alone the level of understanding that you seek to achieve. And, you know, it's pretty amazing.
It blows me away, but their little antennae are just of the adults are just attuned to molecules of the host plant floating through the air, and they somehow triangulate and just zoom right in on isolated plants.
It's just so much of a bigger scheme, so much more complex than we could even grasp. I mean, it's amazing. And so. You know, in gardening, especially lately, we hear about pollinators, 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 and the flowers, 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 but that's not the whole story is what I'm hearing from you then. And that's not exactly what you're looking at either.
Yeah, and even those pollinators, I mean, if you just focus on flowers, I mean, those insects have a whole life cycle that requires more than just flowers. I mean, each bee species has a particular microhabitat it needs, whether it's bare soil to burrow into or hollow stems that they go into to nest. And a lot of pollinators have herbivorous larvae that need a particular host plant to eat. But even setting pollinators aside, I mean, all kinds of amphibians and reptiles and birds and mammals are insectivores, and they need insects to eat. And most herbivorous insects are very host specific and need particular plants to feed on. So you need plant diversity to have good diversity and quantity of insects to support the whole rest of the ecosystem.
Right, all the way up, all the way up. Yeah, absolutely. And these are, you know, ancient relationships. I mean, and as you point out, they're often very intimate and specific, but they're ancient. I mean, these have been going on a very long time, and the spice bush is still surviving.
Right, exactly.
Right? So some of the galls are pretty amazing looking. Some of the leaf mines are so beautiful. I can't even, and we'll show some pictures of yours with the transcript over on awaytogarden.com. And I'll just say about doing the New York Times column, you know, I'm always worried when I do these kind of geeky, I suggest these kind of geeky offbeat stories that aren't, you know, how to plant petunias or how to grow tomatoes. You know, I always worry that my editor will say, that's too crazy, Margaret. But she didn't. And she wrote me a note to say how beautiful the pictures were, how miraculous it was. And this, she's not, you know, this isn't her thing, but she was transfixed by them, you know. So that's the great thing, is that when people do take the time to slow down and key in, like when you helped me with that walk years ago, it opens up a whole nother world of seeing, I think, to people, doesn't it?
Yeah. Oh, that's great to hear.
It's really wonderful. So even though, like, when people see galls, especially, you know, panic is, so you see like a leaf and it's got like these weird blisters, like these raised compartments, and they're different colors, and they're screaming like disease, you know, or panic. But what, so tell us about some of the other crazy gall things. I love all the oak apples too. I'm picking up some as I rake things. I always find them at this time of year, some of the faded ones too.
Yeah, well, there are some really neat, both some wasps and some midges make these complex detachable galls that will actually drop off the leaf when the larva is mature inside. So most of the wasp ones are on oaks, but then there are midge galls like this that drop off of grape leaves, and that there are about 50 different species on hickories that come in all these fancy, some are kind of thorn-like shapes and some are bullet-shaped and spherical fuzzy ones and sticky ones. And then they're on hackberry, a similar diversity of a few dozen species of midge gulls on those.
And midges are like a tiny, almost looks like a mosquito, like a tiny little fly thing. Is that what the midge is? Yeah. Okay. Exactly. Okay. Yeah. It's again, like the oak apples, as they, I think, to kind of loosely call them, because there's different ones. They are quite hilarious looking. I mean, you think like, who made this? How could this be this sphere, this ping pong ball?
Yeah, and some of those like green ping pong balls with purple polka dots, you see, those come out of leaf buds. I mean, sometimes the whole leaf is consumed by the gall, and sometimes it's just kind of stuck on the leaf, but they're similar. Similar sized ones that are hard and have an apple-like flesh inside. And those actually grow on the sides of acorn caps, which you usually don't get to see them in situ because they're up in the canopy. But if you happen to see a shrub, like a scrub oak, sometimes you get to see those at eye level. And there'll be three big, like inch-wide galls all stuck onto a single acorn's cap.
Oh, I see. I haven't seen it on an acorn except in pictures that you've shown me. I haven't seen it in person on an acorn. Yeah, cool. So, you know, I know you teach, you do lectures, you do workshops, and I think often they're for professionals, but I think you also sometimes do it for lay people. Yes, gardeners or just people who love the outdoors.
I mean, yeah, most of the workshops I've done have been more for lay people or enthusiastic naturalists. I've done a few insect tracks and sign week-long seminars at the Eagle Hill Institute in Maine.
And oh, yes.
Yeah, open to whoever wants to spend a week staring at tiny esoteric things.
So, right, and not walking very far, very fast, okay? Right. And so not good for exercise, this is not. how do you tell people to get started? I just wanted to sort of quickly say, like, you know, because this is a great time of year to kind of look around. Like I said, I just went 3 feet outside the back door and there were these great caterpillars this morning, you know, these brown hooded owlets. you know, there's lots to see. So what, how do you tell people to get started? Do they, you know, camera phone, you know, hand lens, like, is there anything we need to bring or?
Yeah, I mean, if you have a camera that does a decent job with, I mean, a lot of phones have decent macro capabilities. Yeah, just start taking pictures. And if you have no clue what you're looking at, iNaturalist or bugguide.net are great places to just start posting pictures, and people will add comments and help you narrow in on an ID. And then once, if you get excited about a particular group, there are all kinds of great books out there.
Right. And it is, it's kind of, I mean, some people will probably be more attracted to the leaf mines and some people to the galls, or, I mean, you know, it's all very interesting. I remember taking that walk with you and we saw a perfect little circular leaf cut in the edge of, a hole cut in the edge of a leaf. And it was a particular type. You right away keyed in on it and you said, oh, that's from a particular type of bee, I think. Do you remember?
Yeah, leaf cutter bee.
Leaf cutter bee, right. And, yeah. And yeah, and I mean, like, you even look at spider webs and have insight into who made them. How did that happen? That's crazy. I love spiders, so that would fascinate. I guess I better start learning about their webs.
When I was working on my first book, I just started going through the insect section in different university libraries or the invertebrate sections, I guess. And I found there was a great old book by Comstock. I think it was published in 1910 or so, just called The Spider Book. And I just went through each kind of spider and described and illustrated in many cases the egg sacs and the webs. And I went through that and other similar books and just kind of jotted down all the descriptions of the webs and egg sacs and then tried to rearrange it. So if you found this thing and didn't know what it was, how could you? I made categories to guide people to identifying these mysteries.
Well, and they are mysteries, but there is a master plan. I mean, clearly a very complex master plan going on out there. So at this time of year in your kind of work practice and your personal, your other projects, what are you keying in on? Like, what are things, and again, we're both in the Northeast, but so it is sometimes regional, but what are some of the things right now that people should look for in these last few minutes? I just wanted to.
Well, there are certain leaf miners that are only active right at the end of the season, just before the leaves drop. So a fun one to look for, which actually will be a few more weeks before they become evident, but there's a tiny moth that mines, or a couple of related tiny moths that mine in aspen leaves. And they, as the leaves are starting to turn color, they have inhibited the plant from withdrawing its chlorophyll from a patch around where the leaf mine is. And so when the leaves fall, you'll see this, what's called a green island surrounding the leaf mine, and the rest of the leaf is yellow. So if you look closely, you'll see the mine in there, and the larva actually does most of its feeding after the leaf has dropped to the ground. And you'll notice all kinds of other leaves with a little patch of green still on them. And if you look in that patch of green, more often than not, you'll see a leaf mine, or sometimes a gall. A gall can cause a similar effect. So that's a great thing to look for at this time of year.
That's crazy. And are you doing any particular project right now? Anything new, or is it mostly we'll work on the iNaturalist project? I mean, that is, maybe we should just take the last minute or two to just talk about that, your North American leaf miner project on iNaturalist. I mean, it's got tens of thousands of submissions, and I mean, it's got a lot of activity going on.
Yeah, I'm working on catching up, or I have been kind of all summer been playing catch up, but I'm about 3 weeks behind right now, and there are over 2,000 observations to go through. So it definitely helps me a lot when people put some effort into identifying things, so I can just click agree if they have it right. But of course, I don't want to discourage people from posting unknown things, but that's my current situation with that. But as we get into winter, I'll easily get caught up on that.
And as you said, you know, a lot of people go to iNaturalist because there's this, you can submit a picture and it can often be identified pretty quickly. But that can't happen unless there is this database of similar pictures that make something recognizable, I guess. I mean, right? Yes. It has to be, so that's why this is so important to compile all these pictures of, let's say, leaf mines. I mean, until there's this mass, this critical mass of information to compare to, the more automatic almost identification isn't going to be possible because there's nothing, no reference, right? Just like when you hadn't done the book yet, original book. Yeah.
It's been neat to watch the computer getting better at, it seems like more often than not, if you post a picture of a leaf mine, it's going to suggest a leaf miner now as the species rather than the plant that you posted.
Right.
That's amazing progress already. And it is getting better and better at the more common species. I definitely wouldn't trust it, but it can point you in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, Charlie, that's because you started this project, which is great. And I so appreciate, as I said, you're coming indoors and talking to me this morning, and we'll have the giveaway with the transcript over on A Way to Garden of Tracks and Sign of Insects and Other Invertebrates, which is definitely the standout field guide in my overstuffed cabinet of field guides. So thank you so much, and I hope I'll talk to you again soon.
All right, my pleasure.
Underwriting support from Color Blends, supplying top quality spring blooming Dutch flower bulbs to landscape professionals and ambitious home gardeners. More information on the web, colorblends.com.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you again soon. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Stitcher or on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening and looking for tracks and sign of insects and other invertebrates meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.